Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye's War Room with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. Very glad that you're all here today. Ian, I know you've flown in at some expense from Dubai.
Expense to the taxpayer, aren't we? Obviously.
We're here to discuss what on earth is going on. Helen, how did this happen?
A very good question, and one to which we still do not, after several days, have an answer.
Well, we've got quite a lot of answers.
Well, yes, we've got a panoply of different answers. Various explanations were offered. Trump seemed to have been on phone calls with half of the US press corps over the previous weekend, and he gave a range of ideas. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, came out and said something which might have been true and was therefore he was immediately had to backtrack on, which was the idea that Israel were going to do strikes on Iran, which they knew Iran would respond to, and so therefore America was preempting that. But that's obviously a very controversial thing to say, you know, that the world's greatest superpower is being dragged into a war by a nation of 8 million people. So he then had to pretend that wasn't what he'd said. In one of those kind of great flat denials that the US administration really specialise in.
Right.
Where they go, no, we didn't. And then they play the clip and they, oh, yeah, you did. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know what? The answer is that nobody really knows. I mean, they did. Last weekend, they were talking about regime change, which they've got. So, Ali Khamenei is now dead. His son, at the time of recording, is wounded but alive.
Yeah,
according to that.
Not a big change then.
Well, no. I think it's a significant change because you now have a supreme leader who you murdered his father, his wife and his child. So he'll have more motivation for reform and reaching out to the West, I would have thought.
Another success mission accomplished.
Yeah, right. But also, there's been all these things about how they want Iranian protesters to rise up and capitalise on the protests. The trouble is that comes after several weeks of thousands upon thousands of them being slaughtered or imprisoned by the regime. The other thing that they've done is obviously the US defunded all of its overseas broadcast operations, including, I believe, one in Farsi, because that was sort of woke madness that just allowed people just to sit on very big sinecures.
And the new supreme leader is called Mojtaba, which is the Farsi for chosen. So when they were having the meeting, I wonder who they were going to choose. But also in his CV, which obviously I've been reading recently to try and catch up, it said he had a very, very influential teacher that formed a lot of his views, called his father.
Right, okay.
The signs have been there for a while that the immediate replacement, and as you say, we don't know how long this will last, is not going to be a leader of the opposition party.
No, so we're not dealing with someone who we can trust because he's been through the British public school system and been deeply inculcated in our ways and values.
No.
Right, okay.
No.
It's continuity Ayatollah is what I'm
hearing. Yeah, hasn't even been to Sandhurst.
Right.
But does that bother Trump? Because, I mean, he did regime change in Venezuela, didn't he? Which consisted of taking out one man and his wife and then just letting the regime carry on as normal, but making sure that some of the oil reserves came the US's way instead.
Yeah, although I'm really not sure how even that's working out, given the reluctance of the US oil companies to invest in a mad Trump scheme, given that they think, even if you think he's going to stay around beyond his term, he's still heading into his 80s. Is it just too cynical to say that Trump just sort of fancied doing it and there was no one around him to stop him?
And the armada's in place. What are you going to do? Send them home?
Right, it would be embarrassing at that point to send them home. And I also think that, you know, Israel has been very clear about the fact that it feels that it wants to just use the opportunity of its current aggressive posture to take out as many regional enemies as possible. You know, Israeli opposition to Iran's nuclear program is long running. I mean, they've done kind of incredible stuff. At one point, they set up a couple of years ago a remote controlled sniper rifle to take out on the top of a mountain to take out an Iranian nuclear scientist. You know, do you remember that terrible mad time when Benjamin Netanyahu posed with that wall of like rack of DVDs where they'd got all of the Iranian nuclear secrets? This has been a long standing preoccupation of Israel. Previous US presidents have been more of the calm down lads view. Donald Trump is not.
But this is also
view.
The nuclear capability, which we were told by one Donald Trump had been totally obliterated last year.
Yeah.
Haven't we?
When they did the strikes last year, he said it was fake news to say that they were only, you know, compromised and not totally obliterated.
So they got going on that again quickly, didn't they?
Given that they keep
assassinating
Iranian nuclear scientists, it's a real testament to their grit that they've got it back up again within 6 months. Yeah,
and it is confusing for sort of readers to say, oh, how's the war on Iran going? Oh, there's a lot happening in Lebanon. Most of the casualties, you know, 300 in a couple of days, seem to be by Israel on a country that isn't the named aggressor.
I think Benjamin Netanyahu has calculated he will never have an American president who is so keen to do all the stuff that he's always wanted to do for a decade or more now. Right. And so there's this is what I mean. This is fundamentally a war about the fact that there is nothing to restrain Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu.
And
right?
Why is there nothing?
Well, there's no international law. For a start, so we have, you know, President Macron has sort of delicately tiptoed up to the edge of saying it's not really in accordance with international law, actually. There was no vote in Congress before this, no congressional authorization for this. No one else in the alliance, the NATO alliance, is willing to kind of speak up to Donald Trump. You know, the most we're getting is Keir Starmer saying, well, you can't use our bases. Oh, no, actually, you can now. And China and Russia, which are allied with Iran, haven't really stepped in any... I mean, I'm sure they're supplying it with intelligence or arms, but they haven't stepped up in any massive way to make a big deal out of this. So who, what is the restraint here on Trump and Netanyahu?
And then some commentators say, well, that's good. There is no restraint.
Indeed. The one thing that might be the restraint, as ever, is the US economy. So as we're talking now, there's overnight been a huge oil price spike. And that is the one thing that people in the White House who aren't called Donald Trump are very worried about. but this has been going on for a long time, right? So the midterms are in November. Traditionally, you'd expect a president's party to lose ground in the midterms, which will be the start of Trump's gentle fading out of public life, if this were to follow classic US presidential second terms. So his team are terribly worried that they can't get him to talk about affordability. You know, he mentions it in passing, but then gets super bored very quickly and is not doing the kind of things you would do if you're worried about it, like rolling back tariffs, like not spending billions of dollars of ordnance in the Middle East with no clear objective.
After 9/11, there was a strong impulse that something must be done. I don't get the sense that that's the same here.
No, the polling on it is really negative. And I'm not surprised about that, because there was absolutely no preparation for it. So a couple of days before the strike, Trump did the State of the Union address, which was incredibly long and rambling. And he did, I think, three paragraphs on Iran. Now, classically, you might want to say, we have this terrible enemy and, you know, to get back to 2003, we're really worried it'll unleash a chemical weapon on us, or we're really worried it's got weapons of mass destruction, or here's the threat that it poses to the world order, or we can't allow this to go on because of this incredible threat. No, he just sort of said we can't let them have a nuclear weapon, and that was really as far as it went. So the American public opinion hasn't been prepared for this.
It was extraordinary. I was going back for reasons that become apparent a bit later in the podcast to a lot of coverage from 2003, and quite how long the build-up to that one was. You know, it was all about, are they going to get a UN second resolution, and are the weapons inspectors going to be allowed to come back? I mean, it was 18 months before they actually moved and kind of went in. Whereas this one just does seem to have done... on a whim, possibly. Do you think he knew it was going to happen, or did Benjamin Netanyahu just phone him up and say it's tomorrow?
I mean, they had been moving, as Andy said, they'd been moving all of the carrier groups into the Mediterranean. So that for over a period of weeks, the day before, the embassies were saying all non-essential staff, please leave, which didn't seem to trickle through to the influencers. At that point, I would be like, I'll see you.
Well, they're essential, though. That's the thing.
Deeply essential posting activities that must be done. And in a way, they hadn't really stopped since last June when they bombed the nuclear facilities, right? That was a ceasefire in the sense of, and we'll come back anytime we like, thank you.
The international inspectors did say that they had found some material. I mean, so there was a small chance to say, actually, it's not totally random, but that was just buried.
Yeah, I really like people have been doing that meme of kind of like, at least in 2003, you took the time to lie to us and you can't even be bothered to do that. Mm. I mean, I think Trump's having a very bad time at the moment. He's had this big rash on his neck. He's been wearing a baseball cap, which for a man who's very vain is an interesting one. So for the fake Situation Room that he's made in Mar-a-Lago, he was sitting there with his baseball cap on. And then he went to a dignified transfer, which is when they receive home the bodies of American servicemen, traditionally like the most solemn occasion. And he was wearing a baseball cap for it.
But it's a white cap. I'm pretty convinced that he's thought, this shows I'm one of the good guys. It's
are we,
back to
are we
fairly
in
basic
Western
symbolism.
John Wayne territory, are we?
I'm afraid we are.
Gary Cooper.
I mean, the Iranian guys, all their hats are black, Andy.
Right.
He is wearing a white hat.
Well, I don't need any further convincing.
That's the level of analysis you're going to get from me.
Although he might put it like, maybe he puts the black hat on when he orders a strike. Like, or maybe it's a bit like the new Pope. Maybe he's sending out kind of signals through the colours of a hat. But
you think it's just something wrong with his hair?
I think it's about the fact that that he's got some, you know, he's had this bruise on his hand that looks like someone's had an IV in it. He's had congested ankles. He's spoken a bit about the fact that that might be chronic venous insufficiency. I think he's struggling through a few health problems.
Which is probably not surprising for a man of his age.
Right, for a man of his age and prodigious Diet Coke and random food consumption. You know, he's not a, you know, and he takes 4 aspirin a day. You know, there's this kind of...
Because he wants lovely thin blood. He doesn't want nasty thick blood. Going
for the classicists listening, I don't think he's got venous insufficiency. No. I think it's Mars.
Oh.
So the war is not legal, it's not popular, it's hugely screwing up the global economy. There are hundreds and hundreds of civilian casualties happening. I mean, we haven't yet completely answered the question of who launched the strike on the primary school, which killed about 170 girls.
Yeah,
but it does look like it was an American strike.
I mean, it could very well be. The Americans haven't denied it. They've just said, Pete Hegseth said...
Trump's denied it.
Well, oh yeah, but I mean, Trump denies everything. I mean, yeah, but at the Pentagon press briefing, the BBC, one of the few legacy outlets that was still kind of allowed in there because of Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War's turnover of kind of the press corps to influencers, they said, you know, what's happening with that? And he said, there's an investigation going on. They said, that's what you said several days ago. Could you hurry this along? And no, they didn't get any further with it.
I mean, there was a piece in the Eye last week suggesting that the overuse of AI with targeting might explain some of these errors, rather than it being a merely malicious desire to blow up schoolchildren, which I don't think is what the Americans are doing. It is just a carelessness and an over-reliance on technology, which does make mistakes.
It's hard to see how the war is going to get any more popular as time goes by if there are more casualties, you know, as there certainly will be Iranian, and whether there are any more American ones. We're used to the idea that Trump makes quick lightning raids, Venezuela, the bombing of the nuclear sites that last June, and then declares victory. It seems as though Iran hasn't received a copy of that script on this occasion.
That's the real fear when you talk to people who cover that region, is that is there a sense among the Iranian leadership that they don't have anything to lose by just continuing to send out drones?
When one of the many justifications being given for it is that they want regime change, isn't there? I mean, there's not really much coming back from that, even if it's amongst a sort of smorgasbord of other justifications.
Yeah.
They want you out.
Yeah, but I think you're right about the popularity aspect of it. I mean, I suspect that will be what eventually prompts Trump to declare that he's definitely won.
Right.
It's all over. Everything's amazing. And then move on to something else. But it is really peculiar, because I sat there at a Trump rally and listened to him saying, I'm the only US president in 80 years who hasn't started any wars. I've ended some. Such a huge part of his appeal. He was, in the 2016 debates, when he had a go at Jeb Bush, for those of you who have long memories, about Iraq, saying, you know, you got us into this stupid war that cost American lives and American billions. What was the point of that? There is a previous version of Trump that there was some blinking away, some neurons saying that this is a bad idea.
It was an absolutely explicit part of his appeal to the American people, wasn't it? It was no more forever wars in the Middle East. And that's what I mean, we were talking about checks and balances on him. How much of a check and balance on him is the MAGA base and those voters? And I suppose if he's not standing for another election, then personally he's got nothing to lose from annoying those people. But.
Well, he has kind of stuffed J.D. Vance quite heavily with this. So the vice president is, you know, known to be America first and isolationist, very much of that tendency. You know, he served in Iraq. And it's really made it quite hard for Vance to run as the vice presidential incumbent in 2028, having been so overwhelmingly kind of humiliated on one of his signature kind of policy positions.
There we have it. The thinnest silver lining imaginable on an otherwise enormous cloud.
I was about to say, he's really nuked J.D. Vance's prospects, and I thought that's not the happiest.
Well, he'll be back in 9 months, won't he? Yeah.
Just to pick up on Adam's point, is only 7 servicemen have died to date, only 7 American servicemen. So obviously large numbers of other people have died, but aren't unpopular wars in America wars in which American servicemen die? I mean, so far, and I mean, I'm not being callous, and you couldn't be more callous than Trump. Yeah, well, people die, it happens in wars, there we go. I mean, I thought quite a jaw-dropping speech. But so far, it's not losses that will make the war unpopular.
the thing that is really toxic for him is the sense of the MAGA base going, why don't you care about the same things that we care about? Right. In, you know, and it is now a very popular conspiracy theory that he did this, as he does everything, to get away from the Epstein files, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a, you know, it's a fringe belief, but it's still quite a lively one among some sections of the base. And then for swing voters, there were people who voted for Trump because inflation was really high and they were having difficulty buying stuff, and they didn't mind all the other mad stuff that he was doing. They just didn't like what Biden was doing. Those people are not diehard committed MAGA heads. They're people who want a functional US economy. Mm. And at the moment, he seems to be interested in everything but their gas prices, for example.
And again, he's telling them, he's saying this is a small price to pay for not having a nuclear Iran. This is in one of his latest speeches. You're thinking, what? So you're admitting today that this war is going to cost the US taxpayer money.
Yeah, if you are a recently minted crypto billionaire, probably lots of things look like a small price to pay, don't they?
Yes.
In terms of the MAGA base, what are their feelings about Israel? Because, I mean, traditionally, the Republican Party's thing has been very much Israel, right or wrong, we are behind them all the way. There's a sort of feeling with this one that if Israel kind of took America into this with them, it's a sort of continuation of, with the attacks on Hezbollah in Beirut as well, it feels like a continuation of one of the eight wars that he said he's already finished as well, doesn't it?
I'm really interested in this because I think it's undercovered. So on the American right, there has been a lot of discourse since October the 7th about the fact that the left has been overtaken by basically sort of Hamas-supporting, kafaya-wearing students, and that this is a driving force of anti-Semitism in the US. Actually, there's a mirror image of that happening on the right. So one of the big stars among Gen Z staffers in Washington, they will admit to watching Nick Fuentes, who is a self-described Christian nationalist, a Holocaust denier, openly anti-Semitic, and somebody who, for that reason, is very critical of the US military alliance with Israel, and saying that he would now vote Democrat. I mean, he's a troll. He's an internet troll. But he does represent something, which is that there is a big part of the institutional class, the younger institutional class, that doesn't see the US-Israel alliance as being something that is completely unquestionable and sacrosanct. And that has huge implications in American politics, for example, because AIPAC, which is the pro-Israeli funding organization, is really influential in lots of congressional races, you know, lots of political races. It funds candidates, and it has a very, you know, specific set of demands about what it thinks that, you know, those candidates should say if it's prepared to back them. And you were already beginning to see candidates backing away slightly on both
sides.
Turning
money down.
Well, so Gavin Newsom is a really interesting example. He has obviously got his eyes on 2028 as a Democratic contender. He's currently governor of California. He said last week that, and he phrased it as someone else saying it, but he said other people have described Israel as an apartheid state. Now, in American politics, this used to be the kind of thing that had people kind of reaching for the, you know, the gin and they're clutching their pearls, that this was a completely unthinkable, unsayable thing to say. But it's not anymore. And then the mirror image of that is on the right. You will have people like very influential commentators like Tucker Carlson, who are incredibly critical of Israel and actually have built up quite a fan base in places like Qatar and Saudi Arabia because of their willingness to say that. Already we knew that popular opinion in America had moved away from Israel. And now that is finding its outlet in some of the elite commentators and some of the kind of niche and underground commentators. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think that this sequence of events will drive those people even further into the arms of, why does Israel dictate the US foreign policy? That's why Marco Rubio came out and kind of cleaned up his statements, because that is a toxic thing to have said to quite a number of people in American political life.
And again, it seems a bit of a U-turn from, you know, back in, God, it's only January, isn't it, when they went into Venezuela. But then the justification for that was this is all about the Donroe Doctrine, which is saying that the Western Hemisphere is, you know, part of the Americas are kind of what we're going to be focusing on now, which is make the Americas great again, I guess. But then suddenly, yeah, no, straight screeching reverse ferret into more wars in the Middle East does seem quite a turnaround.
It makes no sense. And I think people have tried to drive themselves mad in the last week trying to make this make no sense. Mm. And I think if you just go, just imagine he's Caligula and he's made his horse a senator. Hang on, was that him or was that Tiberius?
No, Caligula.
It was Caligula.
It was consul, yeah.
See, the one thing we can't get wrong on this podcast is classics, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's like me showing a Venus insufficiency. I should have said he does need more love, but he doesn't need more war. But I didn't make it clear.
I'm gonna do one deliberate error about either Roman history or the Second World War in every podcast just to keep everyone on their toes.
Thank you. We should come now to the most important question that the war on Iran has raised, which is, why, oh, why is Keir Starmer not invading immediately?
I think that's the official British media stance, isn't it? Or most of us?
Would you like to guess what percentage of people in Britain, according to a recent YouGov poll, describe themselves as being pro-Trump? What percentage of Britons are pro-Trump?
Oh, well, it'll be triple figures.
Which I mean three.
3%. Yeah.
Where was this poll conducted? Inside the Telegraph office?
Well, rather different. How many? 13.
That's higher than I thought it was.
Yes, I thought it would be below 10.
And 67% against, and then a lot of people going, as ever in a poll, going, who? But, you know, and people really associate reform. Reform voters are more pro-Trump than everyone else, Conservative, Labour, Green, whatever, SNP, whatever it might be. And they also, people think of them as being more pro-Trump.
Well, it's not entirely surprising, given that their leader rushed over to Mar-a-Lago last week, no sooner than the war had broken out, to try and have dinner with Trump, didn't he? And got stood up. Poor old Nigel, taking his GB News film crew with him and everything. And yeah,
if he'd just booked it for a wedding, he'd have had a handshake. He'd have been allowed a peek behind the curtain. And he's got no political strategy at all.
But this has been a really big thing in the last week, is lots of the traditional British press, by which I mean mostly print media, Telegraph, Times, so on, say, running articles, I'm just going to quote a few headlines here. Starmer has made Britain irrelevant. Starmer must not equivocate on Iran. What's the point of having aircraft carriers if we aren't prepared to use them? To do what is not made clear. But there is this drumbeat saying we must absolutely right or wrong support America in this, and saying, well, Keir Starmer can't sit on the fence. What actually emerges is that lots of people want Keir Starmer to sit on the fence on this and think that's broadly the correct position. And lots of people are opposed. 49% were opposed to the attack on Iran, as opposed to 28% in favour. It's reasonably clear, public opinion in the UK, but that has not made it through to the papers.
The Daily Mail in particular, I mean, did you see that headline last week? Starmer takes the great out of Britain. And I just thought, this is very odd for a newspaper that presumably still thinks of itself as patriotic, to be kind of piling in with another international leader who's been insulting our Prime Minister and kind of taking his side on it. It just seemed a very bizarre position to be in. Desperate and deluded was their front page headline about Starmer. When, as you say, I think he's pretty much taking a position that most of the British public, or majority of them, would kind of think was quite a sensible one.
And you said to me the Daily Mail was marvellous in invoking the spirit of the other great wartime leader, Sir Tony Blair, who the Mail used to not think of as particularly marvellous.
That was the most extraordinary thing. Yeah, the Mail on Sunday headline saying, you know, Blair says we should have gone in at the first moment. And you just remember, guys, do you remember? You don't like him. You really, really don't like him. And you've been saying for decades what a disaster leaving America and going into Iraq was. It's extraordinary. I mean, even more recently than that, do you remember when Obama was supposedly interfered in the Brexit vote and said we'd be at the back of the queue? Do you remember all of the op-eds from people saying, oh, well, how dare this American interfere? You know, they managed to sort of find their backbones there and be a bit patriotic about it. But no, we seem to have gone over entirely into let's just be the 51st state now, according to certain newspapers.
But you, Adam, you have a very convincing theory as to why.
The key thing about what's happening with a lot of particularly our right-wing press at the moment is that internet advertising is a lot more lucrative in America than it is in Britain, which is why the strategy of most of our British newspapers over the last 5 years or so has been to set up outposts in a couple of them were ahead of it. The Mail Online was ahead of it. The Guardian was long ahead of it, setting up operations in America. But all of the others have kind of been piling resources into New York offices and America-facing websites ever since then. And I think that's sort of, because these days, actual print papers are largely a sort of afterthought and it's all digital first, that whole mindset, I think, of facing an American audience is starting to filter back entirely into kind of the editorial line that they're taking even on the kind of British-facing stuff.
Yeah.
So we've gone very MAGA, basically. You know, we are British newspapers are now kind of semi-American products.
It's as soon as you point it out, it's quite hard not to notice it anymore. It's fascinating.
The Telegraph itself is absolutely seeing itself as a well. We did a story in Street of Shame a couple of weeks ago. The Telegraph have earned themselves a place in the White House press room, which they never had before. If it was a little seat at the back, which they have to share with one of the online outlets. But they are in there. And they were one of us. I mean, the Telegraph were amongst many people last week who appeared to be able just to phone Donald Trump up on his personal mobile and just kind of have a chat to him and say, would you want to slag off our Prime Minister? minister, sir? Yes, I'd be very glad. Will you bring that? Yes, of course I will.
It was even worse than that when the Sun phoned him up. They seemed to have fed him the line. So they said something like, you know, do you think he's just doing this because he's worried about losing the Muslim vote? Basically, right? Is he afraid of offending Muslims? And Trump went, yes, I do think that's probably is why it is. And then, sure enough, that was the splash.
You can't ask leading questions in a British courtroom, can you? But you can if you're speaking to the leader of the free world.
Well, I did think, I thought that was a bit of a rum thing. And I thought, no, you shouldn't be able to trick the US president that easily.
Can I just put in a word for the journalist concerned, who is very, very objective. It was Harry Cole, and it was part of his podcast, which is titled Harry Cole Saves the West. So absolutely, he's going into this objectively.
Andy's furious this podcast isn't called Andy Saves the West. We don't even try and save the West, Andy.
Isn't that what Liz Truss's book was called?
Yeah, well, 10 years to save the West. She didn't specify who would be doing it, I suppose.
But maybe. I don't know if you remember, Liz Truss didn't actually manage to do it. So
no, I was thinking how embarrassing to have taken the title of your product from Liz Truss.
But that's a very good example of the phenomenon you're talking about, right? Which is that Harry was political editor of The Sun for a really long time, and he's now got an American facing online show. So his audience is the MAGA base, right? Whereas even people on the British right are just not in that reflexively pro-American place that, you know, that the MAGA people are.
Yeah, I mean, the Telegraph certainly used to be the paper of the kind of Bufton Tuftons and the retired colonels and things, who are mostly popping up now to say, well, you're not terribly wise for going into another war in the Middle East, you know, we haven't really got the resources for this. But just sort of being ignored in this kind of like, no, no.
And the Buftons are, and, you know, a lot of sympathy for them, pointing out that the running down of the British armed forces can't entirely be laid at the feet of Keir Starmer, given we've had 14 years of the Conservative Party not funding them. Mm-hmm. The fact that there isn't a navy and that the army is, as the eyes repeatedly point out, you know, has had its outsourcing volunteer and recruiting divisions given to someone else means that it's almost entirely ineffective.
But there does seem to be this willful thing of not learning from history anymore. I mean, I wonder if this is part of the war on woke, because we've been told for sort of years and years by a lot of these right wing papers that this is this terrible thing that people want to focus on slavery and the bad things that empire did. And actually, yeah, empire was marvellous, but it now seems to have sort of been extended to, well, about 2003, doesn't it? That we've decided to just rewrite that one as a complete. In fact, would you like to play a game? Yeah. Of 2003 or 2026?
Yes.
Iraq or Iran?
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I'm going to read you some quotes.
Iraq or Iran. The sub-editor's nightmare.
You have to guess. 2006 or 2003.
This is brilliant. Wait. It's Iraq UI.
That's the one. British spies are part of a deep cover operation to track down chemical weapons which could be used in attacks on neighbouring countries such as Israel and Dubai, the Mail on Sunday can reveal. The intelligence officers are working with American counterparts inside the country to locate sites which have been identified as its potential hiding places for nerve agents.
2026.
Yeah, 2026. Oh, it was that. Last Sunday. Okay. Yeah, Glenn Owen in the Mail on Sunday.
I
love that. It sounded so the chemical agents. I was like,
intelligence sources
wearing,
talking about chemical weapons and nerve agents.
I'm wearing skinny jeans. I'm listening to The Strokes. It's all coming back.
Hans Blix is in the news again. Yes.
Yep. Chemical Ali, he's back.
Yep.
Another one. This is an editorial. Britain remains a bridge between America and Europe, even though its spans have been stretched to breaking point by the current crisis. It should be a matter of pride that we, who share so much in terms of democratic ideals with the great English-speaking power across the Atlantic, should have stood shoulder to shoulder with it.
Genuinely cannot tell. 2026, I'll say.
Okay. Nope, 2003.
There we go.
That's the Daily Telegraph on why we need to be right in there, shoulder to shoulder with George W. Okay. Bush. Britain is left muttering about due process, nitpicking over niceties, proclaiming its loyalty to a legal order that others have abandoned. Far from making us look noble, it makes us look fatuous, shifty and unreliable.
2003.
2026. Dan Hanan, the man who is reliably wrong about everything, in the Sunday Telegraph last weekend. Right, one more. An abject lesson in making a laughing stock of Britain. The Prime Minister's slow and inept response placed Britons in harm's way. Other nations acted rapidly to evacuate their people. When it did act, its charter plane broke down and spent 10 hours on the runway. A good thing the Foreign Office wasn't in charge on D-Day. The Prime Minister was utterly misguided from the start. It raises the question, who on earth is advising him?
That's got to be 2026. Surely the Dubai mention, surely.
No, that one's 2011.
Afghanistan.
And it's the Daily Mail talking about Libya.
Oh.
Do you want just one bonus question? Who said last week, when commenting on Donald Trump's justification, one of his justifications for the war, Trump said, if we didn't hit within 2 weeks, they would have had a nuclear weapon. who said of that, he lies so often that he doesn't know the difference anymore.
Is it Alistair Campbell?
It's Chemical Ali Campbell! It is indeed, yes. The man of 45-minute WMD's dodgy dossier fame. So, yeah.
Wow.
We're not learning from history. We can't be bothered anymore.
Can I bring us on to another element of the British coverage? Because so much of the war has been about energy, what it's going to do to oil and gas prices. They've risen enormously over the last week, in particular oil, but gas is creeping up as well. So a large element of this discussion has been what Britain should do in response to this. Can anyone guess the prescription that's gone out far and wide about how we counteract this?
Is it heat pumps?
It's not, no.
Oh, is it just drive less?
It's drill, baby, drill.
Wow.
The reaction has been, well, let's drill the North Sea, which no one has thought to do over the last 50 years. One example, Claire Coutinho, the Conservative shadow energy secretary, has been out there saying, you know, North Sea, North Sea, Ed Miliband is a dangerous fantasist, we need to repeal the Climate Change Act and get cracking.
And to be fair, she was saying that before the war with Iran as well.
Oh, yeah. And she was wrong then. So... Don't you worry. She's wrong then. She's wrong now. She's remained consistent, which I do respect her for. So I've been speaking to a few people about basically the reality of this. So would it interest you to have a little bit of context about this whole discussion? Because it will happen a lot over the next few months.
Your heat pump time has come, hasn't it, really?
It certainly
the solar
has.
Panels. How's your electric charging and your cross-pavement charging solution working out for
Tip
you?
Tip-top.
Yeah, I'll
yeah,
bet.
Yeah. The price of the sunshine hitting my roof has not rocketed tenfold, which is nice. So, I'm not going to be smug,
because
though.
Because we haven't had any sunshine for
no,
a long
I know.
Time.
The way it's been discussed, in particular in the papers, even today, is that we've got 2 days of gas supplies left in this country. This is a disaster. And it's absolutely not. This is how the industry works. Under normal circumstances, most of our gas does not come from the Middle East. It's about 10% at most. Most of it comes from Norway, a bit comes from the North Sea, some comes from America. But we are not reliant for the actual supply of it on the Middle East. The problem is, of course, it's globally traded. The price will rocket, basically, because of these shortages. If this goes on for several months, there will be a concern about how we get that last 8 or 10% replaced, because Britain is really, really, really reliant on gas. We use it for heating a lot of our homes in a way that, you know, most other countries don't. That is potentially a problem there. But that's if this lasts several months, the actual supply of it. In terms of how the North Sea might change the prices, it's almost completely irrelevant. Hmm. That's the thing. So people say, anyone who says to you, we should drill the North Sea, it is equivalent to... Your heroin dealer has raised prices a great deal. Should you start growing your own poppies? The answer is to get off heroin.
Is that because it would now cost a huge amount to extract what's still there?
It's gone.
Or there just isn't any?
It is a really, really, what they call a mature basin. So, you know, Claire Coutinho has been saying, oh, well, Norway has been finding a lot. The amounts they've been finding are sort of up practically in the Arctic Circle. What is left on the UK continental shelf, it's pretty well done.
Do we not own the Arctic Circle?
Afraid not. No,
can
not
we
anymore.
Can we invade it? Seriously, I mean, honest. I mean, you know, if I was writing a leader in a popular paper now, I would say, in another blow to Starmer, we failed to invade the Arctic.
Quick, well, Donald Trump's looking in another direction. Let's take Greenland.
Yeah. So the weird thing is, Adam, you've been talking about short memories. We have been through something very, very similar 4 years ago. Russia invades Ukraine. Prices spiked enormously. Attempts were made then to increase the supply of gas and bring it down. Prices still went up 15-fold. So you cannot North Sea your way out of this.
So what can we do?
I mean, the government has a lot of opportunities to say this is a crisis. You know, you look at countries like Spain, which have hugely increased their renewable capacity. They haven't been affected by quite the same spike in prices. So the government can make a lot of sort of quick decisions to signal, you know, whether that's we need to electrify our home heating, we need to electrify our transport. These are things we can do with domestic supply. Countries mostly have this thing of, have you heard of the energy trilemma? It's
no.
Such a great phrase.
But we're about to.
I'm afraid you are.
Good.
There are three things you've got to choose between when you're getting your energy supply. You want it to be cheap, you want it to be secure, and ideally you'd like it to be low carbon. But loads and loads of countries have said, look, we've got cheap and pretty secure fossil, so we're not so fussed about it being low carbon.
Yeah.
In a world in which these things are no longer cheap or secure, and where China is waiting saying, would you like some batteries and solar panels, that really changes the discussion. And what's going to happen, I think, globally is that lots of countries will scramble for extra supplies, and many will get them. Countries which have a bit less money to spend won't. This is places like Pakistan,
right,
which don't have abundant natural resources. And when Russia invaded Ukraine and gas prices spiked enormously, Pakistan was absolutely left in the lurch. What that led to 2 years later is Pakistan importing an enormous number of solar panels. And in fact, this year they've cancelled lots of gas shipments because they said we just can't take on that much gas. We don't need it anymore because China was there waiting to provide supply. So this was all very different in the oil price shock, you know, nearly 50 years ago. There are now alternatives which a waiting superpower is hoping to supply.
That's so interesting to me because, again, I think there's a difference between some of the legacy media treatment of it, which is that net zero is a ridiculous thing and super silly and whatever, and the reform belief it should be rolled back, versus the view of lots of other people around the world that this is coming to an end. Like this, the era of fossil fuels is coming to an end. And not least among Saudi Arabia, the producer of an enormous amount of them, right, where you will hear the Crown Prince talk about how he's got to find something else for the country to do in a post-fossil fuel future.
Another example, Cuba, which might be next on the invasion list. It's certainly been blockaded for you know, America's just turned off the oil taps. Cuba's now importing a lot of Chinese solar panels in an attempt. I mean, they're really struggling. You know, planes are struggling to refuel in Cuba. They want to keep the lights on. The one downside is that lots of big renewable projects take a lot of upfront investment. And if inflation is very high, and interest rates are very high, it's harder to fund them. But in the long run, oil suppliers don't want their stuff to be inaccessible to lots of people. They'd like the price kept at a reasonable level where they make a lot of money. And people can afford to actually buy it, and they're not desperately casting around for alternatives.
And I think Old Sparky will be returning to this theme in the magazine.
Ian, I presume that when this issue went to press, you were thinking it would have something about the Gordon and Denton by-election on the front.
I did. I had a particularly fine joke about the plumber winning a by-election, and I could put the joke, the cistern is broken, on there. And I thought, well, that would do for the front. By Monday, it didn't feel like it was the biggest story in the world, which is a great shame, because it was really interesting. Not, I think, in ways that a lot of the press covered it. This is extraordinary. Nothing like this has ever happened before, which... Again, it has quite frequently. That is what happens in by-elections. And George Galloway must have been sitting there thinking, what do you mean? I've done exactly this at least twice. How dare anyone say this is a new tactic by the Greens? You know, I've set up new parties. I've gone for this vote. I've won. So there was a sort of feeling that the story had been somewhat missed. But we didn't really have time to go into it enough. So yeah. I think we could... Have a quick look now.
Yeah, and this is really the short memory episode, isn't it? We've got a lot of short memories all over the place. So back to 2003, 2022, and now to George Galloway.
Week before last.
Yeah. So I suppose the question it raises is Starmer screwed? This is a seat with a pretty big Labour majority that's just been completely overturned by the Greens, with a very charismatic local candidate who, you know, was a very winning sort of plumber who kept doing a plastering course throughout the campaign because, you know, what if she didn't win the election? Just, you know, she was clearly very popular and liked, and the message was quite convincing. It was cost of living.
And she was up against Matt Goodwin, who clearly wasn't very popular and certainly not very well liked.
We should say for non-news junkies who Matt Goodwin is as well.
He's a man with an unfortunate surname when he then goes and loses elections and takes it very badly.
He was both a reform candidate and I think probably at the time of recording, the UK's most popular political Substacker.
But that's only because Hannah Spencer MP doesn't have a Substack, I presume.
No, well, she was brilliant on social media. And I think that, you know, the Green Party generally under Zach Polanski has incredibly upped its game. Right. And I think you're right, Ian. The reason I think people kind of panicked and freaked out about it, particularly on the right, was they sort of thought, if there are angry voters who are rebelling against the system and the establishment, i.e. Labour, then the repository for those votes is reform. And then it turns out, actually, no, there's a left-wing version of that. And then people, if they are angry with Labour and still aren't willing to give the Conservatives a look, there's another party out there with just a very, very different set of political priorities that they might also go to.
Because I remember sitting with you guys recording a podcast about a year ago and saying my feeling was that there are as many people out there who are as repulsed by Nigel Farage and reform and will do anything to keep them out, as there are people who are going for the message that he's peddling out there. And I think this election has kind of proved that in a way. Yes, the Greens are doing fantastically well. They're very appealing in terms of the social media stuff and all the stuff they're doing under Zach Polanski. But I think a lot of people would, the dilemma for them in Gorton and Denton was finding which candidate was most likely to keep reform out. And I think that's probably going to be where the battleground is now in the next few coming by-elections and in the next general election. It's going to be a case of reform versus whoever is most likely to keep reform out. Would you agree with that?
There was a very telling instance. So Rob Ford, who's a professor of politics at University of Manchester, did a blog that ran through all the different options. And he said, you know, there's a path to victory for the Greens, but they need to be the alternative to reform. Mm. And sure enough, this got slapped all over their leaflets with, like, if you don't want reform, vote Green, says politics. And he complained and said, well, that's actually not what I said. But it was a classic version of, you know, most of us who are politics nerds will know the concept of the Lib Dem bar chart, right? Which is just sort of mysteriously like, Lib Dems can win here, and you find out that the axis has been massively manipulated. But that's exactly, you're right, Adam, is that it became a reform versus not reform fight. And the interesting thing is that lesson is that could be a very effective way of doing politics. The 2025 election was a Tories versus not the Tories. And voters were very good at tactical voting and sorting themselves. Are you in a seat where actually the Lib Dems are the best challengers to the Tories? You know, one of those maybe West of England seats. Is it going to be Labour the best place to get the Tories out, or is it going to be reform? And something similar happened here. And if you look at all the polling on issues, reform voters are very distinct from everyone else. They don't have a lot of overlap on social issues with other people. They're in their own kind of blob. So there is a kind of left block that people can move through. And people who were Labour voters in 2025 are not going to find it particularly hard to end up as Green voters, right? Whereas it's going to be harder for those reform to capture any extra people. They've, you know, they can cannibalise the Conservative vote, but some of the people who are now still voting Conservative are unlikely, they're more likely to be, perhaps more likely to be socially liberal or don't believe in like the triple lock or whatever it might be, right? Which then makes it very hard for them to kind of be eaten by reform. So the thing that political scientists say that they think about reform is that they probably have a, you know, they have a kind of high floor but a low ceiling in the sense of like, actually, when it comes to it, the next election will be about whether or not Labour can kind of squeeze, how hard can they kind of squeeze them.
Any estate agent will tell you having a high floor and a low ceiling is
bad. Very bad if you're 6'3".
The estate agent would say it's a really new form of living and it'll cost you over $1 million.
Perfect for
which estate agents you've ever met.
Sorry, think, perfect for horizontal living.
I think I should attribute this to Ben Ansell, who's a professor at Oxford. He talks about the fact there's basically a left block and a right block in British politics. And that's the way we've got to kind of see it. There are two pools that people are fishing in. And Labour is doing this awkward straddling, which is why that so many of them were unhappy with Morgan McSweeney as Keir Starmer's chief of staff, because he felt they were spending too much time going after reform voters. So traditionally white working class baby boomers in those north of England constituencies in Wales, at the expense of younger, more socially liberal pro-European voters that they were losing anywhere else. And the feeling is that Labour has been quite complacent about, well, there aren't enough of those people and they're quite geographically concentrated.
Because it's studenty places. Just want to win Brighton and London, is that what they're saying?
Yeah, or Bristol or wherever it might be.
Right.
But actually, we'll really get a sense in the local elections in May about the fact that if there are lots of people who want somewhere to defect from Labour to, are they going to go to reform, or are some of these people going to go to parties on Lib Dems, the Greens in Scotland, the SNP. And the same thing with, I think, the Welsh elections will be a very interesting reform versus anti-reform.
I was interested in her victory speech, in which she said, working hard in this country used to mean something. And I thought, which party is that? I mean, it could be more or less anyone. And traditionally, you'd expect that to be a Tory or a Labour person trying to attract a Tory. No, it's the Green candidate who has a job. You know,
a proper job. She does stuff
that people like.
That is that workers and shirkers argument from the 2015 election. Absolutely, isn't it? I'm actually, when I say that, I can't remember whether that was Ed Miliband or David Cameron that was pushing that particular line.
That was Osborne in particular.
Oh, was it? Right, okay.
Were the workers part of Alarm Clock Britain? Or was that the Just About Managing?
Alarm Clock Britain. Yes.
No, Alarm Clock Britain is Nick Clegg.
Oh, sorry.
And Just About Managing is Ed Miliband.
Who ironically didn't have to set his alarm clock after the election.
And quiet Bat People is the thick of it, which is the one you must not get confused with.
I think Just About Managing is Theresa May.
The Squeezed Middle is Ed Miliband, right. But they're all identifying the same thing, which is people who are economically insecure. And the interesting thing is that we've been used to thinking that as people who are in, you know, deindustrialised parts of perhaps Northern England. Actually, now it applies to 30-something graduates paying back their loans at 9% of their salary, unable to get on the housing ladder, thinking, you know, what is the point? Like, when do I get to settle down and have a family and all those things I've been told constitute a good life?
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the pool that the Greens have been incredibly good at appealing to.
They've got that novelty value as well, which is what Nigel Farage had. That's what stood him so far, was he was one of these people who didn't feel like a normal politician and felt like he was an outsider coming in.
But then Zach Polanski's then got exactly the same problem that Nigel Farage had a couple of years ago, right? Which is, how do you staff all the positions? How do you make it more than just you? But I think he's learned a lot from what has worked for Nigel Farage, which is both having a pop at the mainstream media and saying they're all a hater, say against us, always works really well for populist politicians, but at the same time making yourself really available. Zach Polanski has gone out and done a lot of stuff. Think about the number of interviews he's done versus, say, Kemi Badenoch, right? He's just a lot more visible. He's out there. And yes, he might get into sticky situations when he goes on the rest is politics or whatever, but fundamentally, he's just there in people's faces in a very fractured media environment. In a way that I think, you know, but neither Keir Starmer nor Kemi Badenoch, nor even really Ed Davey for all his, I was going to say waterboarding. I don't mean that, do I?
Paddleboarding.
He's waterboarding at Thorpe Park.
Waterboarding at Thorpe Park.
Yeah. Is the worst day out ever.
Well, that could be an American base by the time this podcast goes out.
Okay, so we come back to, is Keir Starmer screwed?
Yes.
Right. I mean, Helen, you've been telling me for ages Nigel Farage is going to be the next Prime Minister.
I say that we should be very open to the possibility because there have been huge swings. And this was, a massive swing to the Greens with the Reform in second and Labour in third. You know, and in what was previously a really great seat. And the key problem,
a solidly Labour seat.
Yeah, that, you know, there was a large constituency of quite socially conservative Muslims. There was another bit of the seat that was, you know, white graduates, essentially. Now, those are two groups that have, you know, some things in common, but actually electorally you'd imagine want different things. And for one party to be able to get 40% of the vote out of that seat is quite impressive. And a big problem for Labour, because it doesn't show that there's one weird trick that they, you know, why don't you just be meaner to immigrants? Might win you back some of those people, but another of those people. Why don't we be more liberal on social issues? Well, that's going to turn off some of those people. Where do you go? You know, both of them united, by the way. One of the few things they're united on is Gaza, to take us right back to the start, right? Both the kind of, you know, white college graduates and socially conservative Muslim voters, both of them very worried about Britain's involvement in wars in the Middle East. So that, you know, that was something that that Zach Polanski pumped quite hard during.
But it can't all be about that, can it? I mean, when Matt Badlews came out immediately and said, actually, this is all down to the Muslim vote and down to family voting and corruption and everything. But, I mean, if you're going to get a load of socially conservative Muslims to vote for a woman candidate and an openly gay Jewish leader, that's a hell of an achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, it just proves that they ran a very good campaign that spoke to people on the issues that they cared about. That said, there are bits of that campaign I didn't like. In the same way that I think that Reform quite often play white grievance politics, I don't like the Green Party putting out adverts which is showing Keir Starmer with Modi to say, look at him hanging out with
Indian
Hindus. Netanyahu to say, look at him hanging out with a Jew. That, to me, is pressing a button that I don't really want people carving up Britain into different ethnicities and tailoring their message differently, or on religious sectarian grounds.
Yeah. I mean, that's the Zach Goldsmith going for London mayor tactic, isn't it? Was absolutely.
Yes. Leafleting, was it Hindu families saying,
yes, Sadiq Khan is coming for your gold.
He'll take your gold.
Right, exactly. I find it a continuation of the fact that there are people who are madly obsessed with Sadiq Khan, that he's trying to impose Sharia law on Britain, and just say, just because he's a Muslim, I think you need, you know, that's all you need to know about him. That kind of politics is really...
Show some respect, Helen. That's the president of the USA you're talking about.
Really, really ugly wherever it comes from.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. But they've correctly identified that talking about boring old green stuff is not especially interesting.
No one cares about the heat pump.
For listeners of the podcast, there was a section in which Andy was talking about energy, but we've cut it.
Oh, no! Kemi Badenoch's Conservatives got 1.9% of the vote, and that, I think, shows that she's done the work of reducing the vote to its core, and you can build from that.
So I well, do think and her reaction was to say that Keir Starmer is finished. Yes. I love that. That was brilliant.
Yeah. Mirrored by a lot of the press. Yeah. I mean, you pointed again. This out, but...
Yeah.
Hab, Starmer.
They lost their deposit.
All right, we should end this orgy of gloating.
And we haven't even done Dubai influencers. Imagine such a thing, Andy. I think all the gloating that I've got pent up inside me.
We get big, big views on YouTube from Dubai.
Okay, I'll say nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always loved the UAE, and I believe that everything that they do is great.
Absolutely. I know who protects
you
us.
You have to say that when you move to Dubai, which
you've revealed where we're broadcasting from, where the bunker is.
That is it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening and for watching. If you would like to get a copy of Private Eye, it's available in your local newsagent. And if you'd like to get a subscription, it is available at private-eye.co.uk. The latest issue of the magazine has a terrific report from Dr. Grimm, our human rights correspondent, about what life has been like in Iran under the Ayatollahs and under the regime. And it's got plenty more fantastic coverage, fantastic jokes, fantastic cartoons. It's a fantastic magazine. And the price has not spiked tenfold yet, so rush out and get it right now. Thanks to Ian, Helen and Adam. And thanks once again to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.